Viewer discretion is advised. The United Nations of Horror is a podcast about all things horror. Our three hosts hail from different parts of the globe. This gives our listeners a unique perspective. From modern horror classics of yesteryear to the newest releases. From horror novels to historic horror books. If it's about horror, you can be sure that it will indeed be a part of the conversation. Please visit us online at www.unhpodcast.com. We invite you to come interact with us on facebook.com/groups/UN of Horror and on Twitter at twitter.com/UNHPodcast. And now, we welcome you back into our Dungeon of Diabolical Delights. Welcome to the United Nations of Horror.
Hello and welcome to the United Nations of Horror. I'm Becky, and for November, it's my turn to show Lucard and Mark such sights with a film or two they haven't yet seen. As I've talked about the film on a few Listomanias, my choice this time round was Della Morte, Della More from 1994. And before we get stuck in, how are you both and how was your spooky season?
Yeah, pretty good, actually. Not bad at all. I'm not really one of those ones that do 31 Days of Halloween or any of that stuff. I do what I want, right? I've got a permit that says that. I can do what I want. So I just watch what I like. But that is often there's a lot of horror. So, you know,
it's same like a as
same
kill,
old,
right?
Same old. Yeah. It's a bit like that, but it's even better.
There you go. Even better.
It covers
I like it.
That too. I'm all right. And it was fine.
Yeah, likewise. Halloween, you know, it's obviously my favorite holiday. Has been for years. You know, I post pictures all over Twitter throughout the Halloween season of just kind of anything I see that I find cool just during this season. Because there's so much. And, you know, even with everything going on this year, it's been a hard year for everybody, but Halloween is still going forward in some ways, you know, like with watch-alongs, like, you know, like we've been doing and things like that. So you know, by the way, shout out and thanks to everyone who attended that. But yeah, I'm excited to talk about this film today, Becky. This is a really good choice, and I know you've talked about it for a long time, so it's good now to be able to say that we've joined the club and we've watched this as well.
Absolutely, and I'm really excited to put this on the menu, so to speak. And just to give a brief synopsis, Francesco Della Morte is a caretaker of a cemetery in Bufalora, a small town in Italy, in which some but not all of its recently deceased residents come back to life as returners, and the cemetery gates stay resurrectoris for those who will rise again. The returners appear to have some semblance of their former identity, but they feed on the living, and it's Della Morte's duty to kill them a second time via blunt force trauma to the head. And though Della Morte appeals to Bufalora's mayor, played by Stefano Massiarelli, he's too caught up in his re-election campaign, and Della Morte intends to file paperwork with his friend Franco, a municipal clerk, but decides it's easier to kill the dead himself. At that time, Della Morte meets a young widow who changes the course of his destiny and the film itself. So before we get into any plot points, what were your initial thoughts?
I really liked this one. I have problems with Italian films sometimes because they've got a certain disconnect. I think because they've got this tendency in the Italian film industry to loop afterwards, putting the sound up, the talking afterwards. They don't really pay attention to sound on set, and they don't care, so there's all sorts of noise going on, so they have to record afterwards, and that gives it a slight disconnect, which I find a little cold. But this worked for me perfectly well, mainly because Rupert Everett's got a great speaking voice, and even with that looping, you kind of get his character come through very strongly. But I think this was, it reminded me of some of the earlier Italian horror films I really like The Living Dead at Manchester Morgue. It had that kind of vibe.
Good film. Yeah.
And it reminded me a little of that. But yeah, I thought this was really well put together. I really liked the whole vibe of it. I liked the art design. I really liked the music. The theme tune was really interesting and kind of really apt. And it just got crazier and crazier and more fun, actually. It wasn't disorientating in a sort of put you off kind of way. It was just it was a bit disorientating, but it never lost me at any point.
Yeah, I would agree there. I mean, I think my first impression is I was like, what is this, like a zombie film? Because, you know, he's sitting there. I'm assuming it's in like a crypt, you know, and it looks like he's gotten out of the shower. And then he's on the phone with his friend. Suddenly you hear a knock on the door. He opens it. And at first I was just thinking, man, that guy's like a really pale mobster of some sort, you know. And then he shoots him in the head because obviously he's dead. You know, he's got like a bug on him or something. And
yeah,
but it's
they could talk, can't they, these zombies as well? Some of them anyway.
Yeah, yeah. They did a good job with all the makeup effects and everything. And I felt like this film, as it goes on, and, you know, we'll talk about it deeper, of course, but it almost feels like one of those fever dream films. And Italian cinema, I feel like, does that better than any other cinema in the world. Like, oh, it's here, but then it's just crazy. It goes to this next spot, and, you know, you're like you said, Mark, I was able to follow it the entire time, but I was also just like, wow, this is crazy stuff. So it was really cool.
Yeah,
absolutely. And personally, I've been enamored with Italian cinema, for horror cinema, I should say, particularly from a very early age. So I came to a lot of these films quite early. And this film in particular, you know, you talk about the influences in terms of Italian horror cinema, and it's really a love letter to 80s Italian horror, I think, and that's because it's directed by actor, screenwriter and director Michele Soavi, and he for a very long time was Dario Argento's assistant director, and he worked on Tenebrae.
Yeah I could see kind of bits of, I don't know, demons in this.
Well, yeah, Michele Soavi was actually in Demons, you know, the character who hands the girls the tickets.
Yeah,
the women. Sorry,
okay.
That's him with the strange mask on.
Oh, that's crazy.
So he's, because he's an actor as well. So you know, he's worked with Lucio Fulci as well as Argento. He was an actor in City of the Living Dead from 1980, New York Ripper 1982, Demons 1985, and as an assistant director with Argento, he worked on some really big films like Tenebrae 1982, Phenomena 1985, Opera 1987, and it was in 1987 that he went on to direct films himself, and Stage Fright I think was his first film. And then he directed The Church and The Sect. And I believe those are both also marketed as Demons 3 and 4.
Okay, cool.
That's
cool.
Wild.
I'll tell you another film this reminded me of, and I think it's an Italian film. And unfortunately, I can't remember the title. It was called something like Anna and Her Summit
The Apocalypse?
Adventure. No, that's the British one. No, there was like, I think it was a late 70s film. And Lisa and the Devil, also. Remember that one with Telly Savalas?
Yeah.
Bit of that. This other one's going to annoy me. And I know of... I'll try and remember the name. But there was lots of little things. I think there was a touch of giallo about the plotting as well. You know?
Absolutely.
Twists and
yeah, stuff like
that. Yeah, there's a lot of that in there. And Italian cinema is just so distinct. I know we've talked about it some on here before, but there is just so much in Italian horror, really, for us to talk about. You know, so many great films. Fulci, I mean, like I mentioned the whole fever dream thing. Like, to me, all Fulci films just feel like a crazy, crazy fever dream. And there are a lot of criticisms about Fulci, but I thought this managed to, like, keep the plot together a lot better than a lot of those kind of Fulci films. Even though I love Fulci, don't get me wrong.
It's interesting that you say that, because the film is based on the Italian comic Dylan Dog, and that was hugely popular domestically, and its creator, Tiziano Slavi, designed the titular character on Everett after seeing him in a film, and I can't remember the name of the film off the top of my head, but Everett actually owes, he said, his popularity in Italy due to, you know, this, his identification with this particular character. So it was only fitting that he would play the lead in this adaptation. But there's also a book tie-in as well, titled Della Morte, Della More. And it's obviously not this in the same world as Dylan Dog. And his character, Francesco Della Morte, does appear in the series Dylan Dog, the comic series, which is a little bit confusing. But it seems like this film pulls elements from both the book and the series. It's a really strange amalgamation of both worlds. And it was originally published in 1986. And I think there's over like 300 issues. And it was only in 2017, unless I'm mistaken, that an English version was printed. And there's several writers and artists that have contributed to it over the years. And there's even like crossovers with a superhero series, such as, for example, there's a Batman and Dylan Dog crossover.
Oh, heaven.
So, yeah, really interesting. And that ties into the style again, because as Everett himself said, you need to imagine a strip cartoon, which is the film is based on, or storyboard coming to life in terms of the film. And personally, the film very much reminds me of the Italian fotoromanzo or photo novel. And this particular type of medium, stories will be told through captioned photographs. And off the top of my head, Massimo Pupillo's Bloody Pit of Horror is a good example of how the medium is not only referenced narratively but aesthetically kind of defines the film.
Okay, cool. The film felt like it had its own universe well defined, and we were learning the rules as we went, but it felt coherent within those rules. The only exception perhaps being some of the zombies talked and some didn't, and I don't want to get into specifics too much. There was one particular part of a person that was very chatty.
Oh yes.
We'll get into that when we get to the plot. So it was kind of interesting, yeah. And I have to say, some of these Italian actors, they kind of look really familiar, and I couldn't place them, but they just look familiar. Yeah. There was one character, the mayor's daughter, who I thought, I've seen that girl in something, but I think she just looked a lot like Reese Witherspoon. And that's all it was, but it's like I know her from something, because I couldn't find her in anything I'd seen before. So it was just she looked similar to someone, that's all.
Did either of you guys get a kind of Nightmare Before Christmas vibe?
Possibly in some of the art direction.
I mean
a Burton vibe, 100%.
Yeah, there was a Burton vibe,
like a gothic fairy tale sort of vibe almost.
Yeah, I mentioned Lisa and the Devil, but I've figured out what film I was talking about. It wasn't Anna at all. It was called Valerie and Her Week of Wonders. It was a Czechoslovakian film from 1970, and it just felt quite similar to this, interestingly, because I don't know there's much connection between Czechoslovakian cinema and Italian. The very few Czechoslovakian films I've seen are very Italian in style, though, having said that, but I've only seen a couple.
Yeah, the fairy tale mythology elements, you could argue, would be similar. Yeah, 100%. Yeah. But, yeah, just touching on that, I was going to say then, did you think that the film showed any other influences? Off the top of my head, you know, I would say, obviously, and I think Rupert Everett mentioned this as well in a documentary, would be Fellini.
Yeah, I could possibly see some Fellini in there. Certainly when these films go into slightly darker places. I mean, they're never particularly explicit that I remember, but they can get weird. And they're often there's quite a deep allegory in the weird sense. You know, that means something quite specific that you need to read up on about, because you're not that familiar with Italian culture. Do you know what I mean? There's stuff like
that's
that.
That's it. And he did say that the films very much represent a type of corruption in village life in Italy. And okay, if you're not familiar maybe with that, and that in terms of the creator of Dylan Dog and the novel Della Morte, Della More, you know, it's a very specific, unique insight into Italian life in, you know, rural villages Perhaps so.
I also felt that his relationship with Nagi. There was something going on there that I didn't quite understand, in that I felt that that meant something, that was a symbol of something that I didn't quite get. And we kind of find out it might be at the end, but I don't want to get into too much, but it was more like there was little touches, for example, when Nagi does the puzzle and then puts it to one side, and then he comes in and says, "Don't you even try that puzzle, that's the hardest thing in the world," and all this. Nagi says nothing, and Nagi just continues while all sorts of madness is going on around him too, and I felt that was symbolic of something, but I don't know what.
Yeah, secret, I actually played Nagi in this role. No, I really liked him as a character. He was such a lovable character. Yeah,
he was. He did make me laugh when the mayor's daughter talked to him, and he kind of started, like, it looked like his head was going to explode at one point, and then he just threw up on her.
Yeah, it made me laugh too.
Let's kind of get into that. I mean, like, so, you know, as, like I say, there isn't much plot really, but, you know, Nagi becomes infatuated with the mayor's teen daughter, as we said, Valentina, and she was played by Fabiana Fimica. And again, I'm not familiar with her, but I think she looked a lot like, and I can't remember the name of the actress, but she was in Prison Break.
Well, she reminded me of Reese Witherspoon. That's who I really thought that she looked like to me. I haven't seen Prison Break. So I couldn't comment on that.
She is tragically decapitated in a motorcycle accident. It's
pretty graphic.
I was going to say, that's brutal.
Yeah, man. I mean, let's talk about the gore later on, but I mean, do you want to cover that now?
Yeah, I'd have to also say the bit with bikers, like, jumping out of graves reminded me of the old British movie Psychomania as well. At one point I thought we were going to go Psychomania on this, actually. I thought the bikers were going to be way more significant than they turned out to be. But there's some weird old lines in this that made me laugh, like, he can eat me if he wants to, or whatever the girl said, who was, like, obsessed with this dead guy.
We should clarify that the mayor's teen daughter, so obviously Nagi's very taken with her, and he vomits all over her. That's his way of showing affection, apparently. He can't contain it.
It's about Stan from South Park.
Exactly. And she's covered in sick, and she ends up jumping on the motorcycle of a friend, a boyfriend, whatever. Her father's like, whatever, the mayor's there, you know, with Del Morte. There's like a weird town meeting. I don't know. But the young man takes her on his motorcycle, and she's telling him to go faster and faster. And it's not only is this obviously a horrible accident, but the bus that they collide with is full of, I think, scouts. So young children.
And they all die.
And they all die.
It's Delamorte says, "Oh, it's going to be a busy week." Or
the dry humor in this. And that's, again, why it was included on my Listomania horridy comma list.
Yeah, I'll tell you what, I just thought of another film that I felt was similar, not necessarily an influence. It was the sheer ennui of the whole film, you know, Rupert Everett, doing stuff, but doing it in a kind of tired, desolate way. Reminded me a lot of a Belgian horror film called Daughters of Darkness.
Which is
women stuck in a hotel that's kind of closed for the season, and there's this like air of gloom and sort of not really having energy to do anything other than just get through each day, and Delamorte was kind of like that, wasn't he?
Very much so. And I think, you know, the times we're living through at the moment, I think everybody's is experiencing some kind of exhaustion or that type of mental
ennui.
Exactly. Yeah, absolutely. And Daughters of Darkness did a really interesting thing in terms of the vampire narrative. And I think this film does the same thing for zombies in a way.
Yeah, they did. And these zombies are kind of unlike any other screen zombies. I mean, maybe the ones from Return of the Living Dead are similar. Yeah.
I was thinking that too.
And I'm trying to think if there's any other zombies with agency. I mean, I think there's some more modern films, quite recent films. Where
is it Land of the Dead?
Possibly.
The newest one where they try to like reclaim New York or something.
Oh, yeah, and
then there's the Romero film where the zombies, the one zombie talks a little bit.
Is that the one I'm thinking of? Like,
That's Day after
Dark. So. Dennis Hopper.
No. There's Land of the Dead was the fourth one. Then there was Diary of the Dead. Then there was Something of the Dead where they. That was pretty bad. It was a pretty bad film. I remember that.
I mean, it's essentially like kind of an allegory against war. I'm sure people are like shouting at me right now, but I can't remember the name. It came out back in the 80s, though.
It's something like, it's not Resurrection. No, hold on. What? Hold on. We're talking different 1980s? Things here.
I'm going to have to look it up.
The one I'm thinking of is the one with Dennis Hopper and the zombies have some kind of...
That's Land of the Dead.
Is it Land of the Dead? And for me,
there's
it was...
speaking zombies in that.
Well, the main guy from the, I think he works like a gas station. He's kind of leading the zombies. It just reminded me very much of a horror version of the New Planet of the Apes, whatever it was called.
Okay. Yeah, I was thinking of Day of the Dead from 1985.
Okay.
Where the
yeah,
the
there's
doctor...
no talking zombies. Yeah.
Does Bob have a bit?
Bob, his actions indicate some intelligence.
Yeah,
that's
like
all.
He's trying a gun, to talk. Doesn't he? I know. I don't know that he's really. I don't think he has, like, really comprehensive words, I guess you would say.
No. But he's one of the few zombies that's got a personality, isn't
right.
he?
Right, exactly.
And I think that's kind of led to the recent, for example, what's it called? Was it Warm Bodies?
Warm Bodies was a zombie love story.
Yeah, and, you know, he regains his humanity. And that was really interesting, and how that's kind of picked up on that agency, and also... There is a television series, iZombie.
Is there?
Again, I think she's like a kind of PI. She eats. She's turned into a zombie, and she eats the brains of recently deceased people to find out who murdered them.
Yeah, and then she takes on their personality, which is really the actress is great. Who
that sounds like an interesting premise, at least a different one. The last Romero zombie film was called Survival of the Dead, by the way.
Right.
Yes.
Yeah.
But yeah,
who else was in it? Who played in Twin Peaks the Windermere?
Windermere, very nice, very nice.
He was in it. It's a bad film though. He's good. He's good. You know, it's not a good film.
Well, just kind of pulling that round, I just have to add the any other influences. Personally, I would think that Jean Rollin's films are very much an influence in terms of this one because of their sensuality and the surreal, dreamlike melding of different worlds. So reality, this supernatural
world. I've read a good review of this, and I wish I could remember what it was, but they said something like, this is David Lynch meets something, but I can't remember the other half. But there is a tiny bit of Lynchian things. It's not as abstract as Lynch, though.
No, there's so much in it, and it also, like, it kind of predates what Guillermo del Toro has done, I think.
Yeah. Yeah,
in terms of the mythology and such. But I mean, and that's the thing. And Rupert Everett in an interview said that, you know, if you haven't read or you're not familiar with Dylan Dog, the cartoon, and obviously an Italian audience will be much more familiar with this than we would, then the film might come off as being very peculiar and very strange. But I don't know, like, it just has a real charm for me.
It also reminded me somewhat, both structurally and tone, of Eraserhead as well. There was a touch of Eraserhead about it. You know, a lone man trying to make sense, but weird things keep happening to him. But he just kind of... it's interesting, in Eraserhead, Henry, the main character in Eraserhead, is just confused and baffled by what's going on. Whereas Delamorte is just like, whatever, and just kind of does stuff, just goes along with it. I did like, there's some weird stuff like the young widow, like, mentioned at ossuary, and she kind of goes sex mad.
Yeah.
Well, Les touched on that, right? Because, so.
I want an ossuary.
So Delamorte is, he seems to be depressed in some kind of form. What's really interesting about his character, you know, he didn't finish college. He's only read two books in his life, one of which he didn't finish. And his hobbies include finding deceased people in the cemetery in old phone books and crossing their names out. And also a school jigsaw, apparently.
It's interesting that he does mention to the old lady who calls him the engineer that he's got a degree in biology. And then later on, he's sort of saying, I haven't got a degree. Himself, right?
Well, that's it. Like, and I think it's all about playing around with, you know, reality, how you present yourself, depression. There's so many layers to this film that, you know, at first it appears to be, obviously it's very convoluted, but some really interesting things to pick apart, I think. And coming back to his character, there are various moments in the film that people reference his impotence, which I think is really interesting, because his relationship with this woman, as you said about the ossuary, is completely defined, it seems, by sex and lust.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, I don't, the impotence thing came kind of from left field, because it just started being talked about, and it's like, what's going on here?
just because of the girl he's interested in too, I was like, man, he is lonely.
Of course, like, you know, he's basically that there is a widow whose elderly husband has passed away, and we never know her name, and he's obviously attracted to her, and she comes back to visit the grave, and she's drawn to him, and De La Morte shows her the ossuary, and it appears that there are like parts of people in there, like skeletons and such, that seem to grab her and have,
yeah, rip her clothes off.
Yeah,
that was weird. Yeah. And that never gets talked about, does it? It just kind of happens.
I was just kind of like, well, it's an Italian film, so it's fine.
Yeah, it's fine. That.
It's like the cemetery itself is alive in some way, and she keeps saying things that don't really make sense. Like, you know, I can't do this, as if she's having a conversation with someone else. I don't know, but she ends up consummating their relationship beside her husband's grave, and she tells De La Morte that, you know, oh, my husband and I never had any secrets, or he'd want to know this. It's like, okay. And what did you think of the, it's quite a sensual film. It's very graphic in one respect.
Well, it is. Yeah, I thought it was fine. It kind of didn't feel out of place, because it starts with Rupert Everett in the bath pretty much, doesn't it? You know, coming out of a shower.
Come on, if you look like Rupert Everett in the 1990s. I mean, he is a beautiful man.
I'm not complaining. I've got no problem with it. I'm just saying that's why when the woman also gets naked, it just feels part of the same tone, really.
Right? Yeah.
I mean, she's beautiful too. Anna Fauci's very interesting, striking-looking woman. She's half Finnish, half Italian, I believe. I think she did quite a good job. I mean, she wasn't given much to do in terms of presenting the various roles she played in this in any kind of different ways, but she was quite effective and worked in the job. She was like almost like a more up-to-date version of what's her name, Barbara Steele, is it, the one that's in a lot of the early Italian,
do you think?
Maybe not. She had striking look about her, is what I mean, really.
Yeah, no, totally. But I mean, I think she was like a TV personality in Italy.
So really?
She was a presenter. So I think she'd be much more well known again in Italy than here. So this film has a completely different reading and familiarity over there than it would for us, I think, which is interesting. But I mean, she is absolutely beautiful. And together, they are both beautiful.
Very beautiful.
I think that the film does a really, it's good that you mentioned that, because the film very much, I think, is equal in the nudity and the way that it presents those sex scenes. It's not overly tilted towards the woman, and I don't think it's exploitative in that way.
Yeah, no, it's definitely
felt,
equal.
It felt straightforward, yeah.
Which I felt, and it's slightly different, I think, for you know, an Italian film. And bear in mind, this is the 90s, and obviously it's very much drawn from 1980s and some, I think, films in the 1970s. But yeah, that was quite interesting and good, I thought, that it was quite equal in that way. And just to touch on that, to say that the film came out in 1994, and obviously you can see the dubbing on the cut that we watched.
I thought it was pretty good dub, though, actually.
Yeah, I was very impressed.
It didn't draw you up too much, but the film...
No, I mean, a lot of the actors were talking English. It was exact lip-syncing. So I think we say it's dubbed, but I think it was filmed in English. It comes across as dubbed only because they looped it afterwards.
Yeah,
it was filmed in English, and I think it happens a lot with, for example, from my knowledge of Italian films, where if it's an Italian actor, they would get an English actor there to then record the lines And they would say it and the same thing. But the American distributor October Films released the film in 1996, and they changed the title into Cemetery Man. So that's why we have the dual title.
Mm, yeah.
A good title for it, I think. You know, I mean, especially for kind of the American market. I think it gives you a very basic idea of what the film is about. But I would imagine, like, people who saw it in the cinema at the time were probably like, what the hell did I just see? You know, especially in 94.
Funny enough, talking of dubbing and so on, this reminds me of another set of films, well, a certain set of films from the same director, sort of an auto director that it kind of reminded me of, and that would be Jodorowsky. Santa Sangre feels quite similar to this in many ways, in the sort of nightmarish dream reality kind of way. That is a terrific film. That would made a really good pairing with this. That would be a hell of a double bill, actually. So yeah, I can see Jodorowsky being a bit in here, but Jodorowsky's weirder than this. This felt like it wasn't as weird as some, you know, a lot of cinema we watch. You know, it's not as weird as Lynch, and it's not as weird as Jodorowsky, but it's kind of bordering weird. And any kind of dream reality film, and that can be from the sort of horror thing, or it can be stuff like, I don't know, Taxi Driver has this kind of vibe, doesn't it? Has this kind of slightly disconcerting vibe. And the good ones keep you on board. And this is one of the good ones. So, you know.
That's yep, cool. I agree. It's definitely got that fever dream quality to it where you can't help but just keep watching. And, you know, it does draw you in. You really do want to know what's going to happen. I know at the beginning, like with the, you know, the sex scene with the widow and everything, I was kind of like, what? Like, what is this? You know, but it, like I said, it really, it drew me in quickly. And I also like the pairing, with, De La Morte and Nagi. I think that, that was just a lot of fun too.
Yeah. Nagi was a relief character, comedy relief character. He was kind of like a bizarro version of Curly from the Three Stages, isn't he, really? He's kind of a bit of that.
He can only say like a few words and, you know.
Well, he just says, nah, apart from right at the end. That's all he says, really.
Yeah, pretty much.
But whatever he said, it was funny because De La Morte kind of understood him. So it was a bit like Groot.
Yeah, but, you know what? That's a good, comparison.
Yeah.
Yep, absolutely. And in Dylan Dog, the comics, Dylan Dog's psychic is called Groucho, which is interesting.
Okay.
What you mentioned there. Mm. Yep, but they had to change that, obviously, for the 2011 film, which we'll talk about later.
Yeah.
But coming back to the widow, so they have sex by the tomb of her dead husband, and he comes back to life. Well, he's resurrected and he bites her, and then she passes away. The coroner says that her death was caused by a heart failure, and Rupert Everett's character, De La Morte, waits in the ossuary for her to come back to life, and he can't bear to do what he has to do, so he closes his eyes and shoots, and the bullet just grazes her head. And then later on she comes back again, so it appears that she wasn't actually dead and he murdered her. What did you think of that?
Yeah, well, okay. I thought that, you see, when she sort of sat up, she spoke and he shot her, and then I thought, that seems weird. But then I remember the first one we see kind of speaks, doesn't he? So, and it's like, oh, okay.
I felt bad.
And also, all the previous ones took 7 days, and this was like, we were in a few hours, wasn't it? So I was a bit like, maybe he shouldn't have shot her. But he didn't seem that bothered either way. And I like the sort of grumpy police, the smirking. I don't know if he was grumpy, the sort of world-weary police guy that was investigating it.
The detective.
And again, he reminded me, like I've already mentioned, Living Dead at Manchester Morgue, there's a similar kind of detective in that, played by Arthur Kennedy. And it was kind of, and he even looked a bit, this guy looked a bit like Arthur Kennedy mixed with Jack Warner. the actor Jack, the old actor Jack Warner, the one who plays a grandpa in a lot of stuff. I don't know if you know that actor, but he kind of looked like a cross between the two of them to me. And he was a weird character too. And again, that felt like Dream, because he was just making excuses for Della Morte, wasn't he? Ah, you didn't do this, yeah. Which is kind of what happens in Dreams.
Exactly.
I knew it wasn't you. Someone was having sex with him. Oh, well, it can't be you, so we have to look for another guy. It's like, what?
Because of his impotence, and that was because, like, what?
There was a rumor in the town, right?
Yeah, and he's obviously an outsider in this town, and I don't know whether that's because he's moved there, or I have no idea. It doesn't give you any more information in the film, but and I haven't read obviously the novel Della Morte, Della More, and that I don't believe ever had an English release.
Okay.
So that's something that I, you know, just want to put out there, that I don't know the details in terms of the original novel there.
Yeah. But, I mean, yeah, anyway, he just shoots her, right? But then when she comes, so I don't know if I'm jumping in, but she comes back a second time. Whoa, what? The, what? Some of that imagery was kind of out of Japanese cinema, almost. Yeah. It was kind of...
She looks like Poison strange. Ivy, doesn't she? From
she was. That was really something. Yes. That looked like a comic book kind of image.
Well, and it was very, for me, reminiscent of, again, Jean Rollin films, and particularly his final film, I think, which is the Mask of Medusa, but that was made, you know, much later. But I think it kind of pulls back into his use of mythology, and particularly, you know, women and female characters in mythology. But
she did look like a fury. She also reminded me a bit of the woman in Army of Darkness. There's some shots of the woman in Army of Darkness when she's turned. It looked quite a lot like that.
Yeah. As well. Similar for sure.
Yeah. She was something.
Well, and she comes back again.
Yes.
And that's the thing, you know, he thinks he's killed her for a second time, and he goes into this deeper depression, shall we say. And during this time, we've already spoken about the, you know, he's had meetings with the mayor because of this problem in the cemetery, and the mayor's not very interested, and he, Della Morte, this is, just decides, oh, I'll carry on, you know, I'm shooting him in the head and whatever. And his lover, shall we call her, for the second time, because they seem to have this star-crossed connection. And that's what the whole film is about for me. You know, it's about the relationship between love and death and destiny and such.
Yeah.
And after he kills her the second time, he actually gets a visit from death himself.
Oh, I like this. This part really was like cool. This scene. Yeah. This death puppet or whatever it was really cool. Reminded me a bit of Devil Rides Out, but a better version of the Angel of Death.
And I love how the papers all formed to create... you know, this figure. I thought was really interesting, considering what the whole film's based on.
Was that, do you think that was practical? It looked it, didn't it?
Yes,
I didn't 100%. See any faults with it. It was really something. I mean, CG would have been terrible at this point, so we'd have seen it, right? But
no, 100%. And, you know, at the same time as all of this is going on, we see Della Morte going into the town and literally grabbing a gun and shooting at people with his phone book. And it seems to be that instead of picking out names of the deceased in old phone books, he's now deciding who he wants to kill from them, is how I took it.
Because the death kind of says that, right? What's the difference? You shoot the dead.
Stop killing the dead. Go and kill the, if you dead, kill, the living.
Kill the living.
Yeah.
Be easier or something like that. And again, the copper's like, it wasn't, it's fine.
Not a big deal.
I saw your car, but
it'll be fine.
Meanwhile the Nagi's dug up the mayor's daughter's head, right?
So we've got this separate storyline where the mayor's daughter, like,
sweet little romance with a head.
I gotta say, this was my favorite part of the film. It's so weird. And this reminds me of Japanese film too, this whole thing.
For sure, the head flying around is
exactly.
The bit where the head followed him was he walked through the graveyard. I was like, what the?
Yeah. There's nothing like that.
That did make me laugh. I did laugh out loud for that bit. Yes.
That's what it's like having rabbits.
Yeah. I like the fact they also tied it together. There's one point where Della Morte's just shooting loads, you know, because the scouts turn up That's good. It's just
that was, I was going to say, and they actually turn up. The funny bit about that scene is De La Morte is in the shower.
Yeah.
And he actually makes a comment, you know, they've turned very quickly. I think the rule within the film is that people who are going to be resurrected, and it's not everybody, apparently. I don't know why that is, but if they are going to resurrect it, it will be within 7 days. And the scouts have actually apparently turned quite quickly.
Maybe and they're young and more, got more energy or something.
Very interesting. But I mean, like, I was going to ask you who are, you know, which zombie, if you will, was your favorite, because I have to say that the scouts, the one with the chattering teeth, really, I was like, oh, that's terrible. That was my favorite.
That was a good one.
Well, my favorite was probably the woman when she came back the second time, I think. But there were some cool ones. I like the fact, sorry, I was also talking about that, but he shot the telly because Nagi, he was just eating his meal for all of this chaos, wasn't he?
With headphones on, bless him. Yeah.
Oh, okay. Rupert Everett shot the telly, didn't he? And then he uses the telly as the place to put the head.
Yeah.
And doesn't the mayor say at one point, what are you doing on TV or something?
Yeah, so just like to clarify this. So Nagi obviously has this attachment to the mayor's daughter, and from her gravestone I think she's about 13-14, which is a little okay. Yeah, very creepy. But
yeah, I thought
the same thing. I didn't notice that.
But like Rupert Everett says to Nagi, sorry, De La Morte says to Nagi, you know, you're not a child, you think you're a child, but you're not, you're a year older than me. But I think his, you know, mentality, he believes himself to be of that age, maybe, or he's more innocent. So I think their relationship is very, very innocent, and I will say
yeah.
that.
I agree. And well, I think it is too, yeah.
Yeah, that's so a case, but, I got. You
know, she yeah. just likes talking to him, and she thinks he's kind of sweet, and he kind of yeah. just listens, doesn't he?
That's it, and he wants to give her a kiss, and he's literally just a little peck and whatever. And
she appears to be entirely consenting.
And she says that to him, yeah, absolutely. She very much says that. So
yeah.
he installs her head. I think she's been decapitated. I don't think he pulled her head off the body.
No. She was decapitated in the
crash. Yeah,
and her body was kind of squashed, right?
Yeah. Right.
And so when they buried her head was in a certain place, and he just removed it, right? He didn't pull it off. But the weird thing is, the mayor wants to pretend to be grieving to get votes, and he digs his daughter up to get...
What a dirtbag.
To take pictures with it. It's like,
well, he deserves... Well, guys, without getting too political, would you put that past anyone?
You know what? No.
Yeah, I would, really.
But,
digging up your daughter.
Well, you know, I mean, shameless kind of agendas around.
Yeah. But, oh,
you know, at the end of the day, it's a film, so it's the extreme version of that.
It's an allegory, okay.
Absolutely.
But so, it's a ridiculous plot contrivance. And then he hears his own daughter, doesn't he? He can hear her.
Isn't she
saying, Daddy,
come here. Yeah. But again, coming back to Italian film, like, you know, the majority of Italian films that I've seen, you know, they are strange. They are nightmarish. They are surreal fever dreams, and do you know what I mean? Like, for me, this isn't that out of the ordinary.
No, it isn't that unusual.
I mean,
but I mean,
it was funny, right?
It was. I think it was meant to be like satirical, and just, I mean, it definitely works well in the current day we live in with politics and politicians.
And, you know, she invites the father to come in. But at the end of the day, we know that the zombies need to feed. And De La Morte makes the comment to Nagi that, you know, she's starting to turn. In other words, like, you know, these zombies have a shelf life, which is an interesting.
Yeah. She says it herself, doesn't she? She says, I'm not getting better. I'm getting less fresh every day or something like that.
You know, I'm not a catch kind of thing, you know, because she wants to marry him. She wants her father's consent. But that's an interesting allusion to an element of the film that it doesn't really go into. But, you know, these zombies are not only retain an element of their identity, but they're very self-aware in that respect. Mm. And that's even scarier, more tragic when you think about it.
Yeah, because it feels more like murder than...
Well, not even murder. Like, she knows she's not going to be around forever. She's in the second state, so to speak.
Yeah.
And she's not going to be around for very long. And then that's it. She's gone. If that makes sense. So, but also her father, they seem to have this kind of psychotic, like, the zombies retain some semblance, like I said, of their identity, but they very much are designed to eat and feed and kill. And even with the widow's husband who's passed away, he still feeds on her.
Yeah.
So is that, you know, that's kind of taken out the window in one respect?
Yeah, indeed. There's all sorts of, I mean, the crazy biker stuff we haven't really touched on, have we? We mentioned that there was this obsessed girl.
So the maid's daughter who went on the bike with the young man, he apparently had a girlfriend, and she, even though he was betrothed in a sense to the maid's daughter, because I'm guessing that their family's status, there was a girl who was his girlfriend, and she throws herself on the coffin. She goes back to the cemetery at night and won't leave, and there's a tremendous rumbling. And I was thinking, oh god, what's happening? Is everybody going to come out of the graves? But it seems that the young man was buried with his bike.
Yeah, like Psychomania. Yeah.
I guess, you know, some people have championship belts, some people have motorcycles.
Yeah.
And yeah, he comes straight out of the earth on his bike, and he, you know, starts to drive away, but she begs him to take her with him, and he does. He pulls her onto the bike, and Delamorte is like, stupid cow kind of thing. Follows her, and you can hear this moaning, and it sounds almost sexual.
Yeah, that's what I thought.
Sexual, but then he was actually eating her, and she was all right with it, or something.
Well, that's love, isn't it? You know,
that is love.
It, apparently, you know, complete consummation. But
So she says, like, the line is something like, you know, I can feed myself to who I want to, or something.
Yes, exactly. And Delmos is like, oh, for God's sake! So he shoots him. Because let's not forget that when the widow comes back, so Delamorte thinks that she's dead, he shoots her, she comes back from the grave and actually catches him unaware, and she actually bites him. And the bite itself won't kill you. And that's what makes her death even more pronounced, because when her husband bit her, that wouldn't have killed her. And that's why the pathologist says that she died from a heart attack. Even though obviously she was apparently buried alive, the film is suggesting. So Delamorte has been bitten, but he's not turning. What's interesting is that from that bite, we get his depression, because he realizes, have I killed somebody that was alive? But it's interesting that from that particular bite, his world shifts, his mentality shifts, but also if you think about it, the genre of the film shifts from a zombie film to a giallo.
Yeah, it does. I always felt like at this point his depression wasn't really because he killed her. It was more like, oh, I'm alone again, and it's all the same thing over and over. That's the vibe I got, actually, from Everett there.
You know, it's interesting that the film really did deal with a lot of issues of depression, especially, you know, in 94. I guess this is maybe the time when people were really starting to learn that, hey, depression is a real thing. I don't know, maybe that's reading too much into it, but it could be.
I don't think so, because I mean, you know, if we talk about the different incarnations of the widow, or his fated love, shall we say, then the second incarnation, our manifestation, is I think she's a PA to the new mayor, because the current mayor has
acting up as mayor, whoever that is. And they got an instant bond, and they talk about it, and she then sort of says she's terrified of manhood, I think is a word, or something like that. Yeah. She hasn't had sex, and she's terrified of it.
It's sexual, penetration.
Yeah.
So, at that point, had Delamorte gone to the doctor, or was it after he went?
After he went, then he went to the doctor. Penis removed.
He wants his penis removed, yes. And the doctor's saying, he's saying, well, why do you need that? Like, because you're impotent. What's the problem? And then the doctor says, I'll give you an injection to induce temporary impotence.
Oh,
yeah, and that needle. Whoa!
I was gonna say too, man. Oh, if you're a guy, you didn't wince during that, you're a stronger man than me.
And that's, and like for me, the film has this strange, in terms of temporal, you know, cyclical kind of narrative. I was thinking, oh, is this? Does this affect every other thing? You know, is this out of sync or whatever? But that was just really interesting how the film keeps coming back to his impotence. And again, that might be referenced more in the novel, and I couldn't genuinely say. So
yeah, who knows? And then we get this rather weird thing where she says, "Oh no, he, you know, her boss sort of made her have sex, but then she started to enjoy it, so she's lost her phobia."
Even after he's had all that done.
Yeah, so I was a bit like, this has got some really interesting things that the film is saying about, well, you know, about women and sex.
That's kind of a 50s, before pre-50s kind of thing, I feel.
Really? To kind of say that overtly?
I've read things from old literature where that's kind of done, and the women then fall in love with the rapist. I've read it, and it seems like a quite a horrible thing, but that seems to be a thing from that
Stockholm syndrome.
Yeah, exactly. I've heard that before, but like too. A more extreme thing, you know, a physical violation. It's
very
could
strange.
That happen? Anyway. Yeah. Let's assume it's just dream logic again, right?
Well, it very much reminded me of the film Two Women from 1960, which stars Sophia Loren. And it's about a widow shopkeeper, and she's raising her young daughter. I think she's like 12 years old. And, you know, they are both raped. And it really very much reminded me of this film.
This is a touchy subject. I'm not really sure I'll talk about it too much. It just seemed very odd and kind of an old-fashioned way of presenting things. But I, within the dream logic, okay, you know.
Yeah.
If this had been a more realistic film, it would have been quite
right.
A point where you think, I can't really engage with this film anymore. Do you know what I mean? But
yeah. Absolutely. And I think the film touches on, for me personally, it's more about masculine fears.
I think so too.
I think that, yeah, this is a reflection of, this is like a man's nightmare about a relationship, right? He falls in love. Somehow accidentally she dies, then he accidentally kills her, and then he meets her again and she's been raped by someone else and wants to marry him. It's like, what the hell?
That's it. And then and that ties in to the next incarnation, because at this point he encounters the woman again, but she is a sex worker,
and he doesn't know this, does he?
He doesn't know they have sex. I mean, there's actually a humorous moment when, you know, that he tries to kind of go in for a fourth round, is it? And she tells him, we've already, you know, I've let's be crude, but she says, you know, I've come three times already, which I very much that was really funny.
It was funny, I agree. Yeah.
But, you know, they're together, and then he meets somebody else in the household who tells him, oh, you need to pay this much for this, and, you know, the fact that she told you she wants you to stay the night and she loves you, even though he thinks this is his soulmate, reincarnated, whatever.
And then let's be clear, her language is the same as the other incarnations, right? So it's entirely consistent with this sudden, you know, whirlwind sort of relationships.
Absolutely.
Each time. But this time it's the sex worker saying it for the benefit of that,
which I thought was fascinating, because beforehand you could take, you know, his destiny, and, you know, like within the ossuary, like you mentioned, Matt, you know, she suddenly turned on and absolutely all over him in the ossuary and whatever, with no indication as to why. But because of this context, and, you know, sex workers, and again, it's opening up for me, the film is opening up dialogues about a variety of different things really interestingly without going into too much detail.
Yes, it's certainly open to further analysis. I bet there's books about this, right? I'm sure there must be.
I don't think so, but, you know, you'd hope so.
There's a lot going on.
And again,
you say, it does feel like a masculine dream.
Coming back to that, you know, I mentioned it in the beginning, in the synopsis, that De La Morte's friend Franco, the municipal clerk, played by Anton Alexander, he's actually accused at this point of the murders that Della Morte we've seen to be committing. So not only of the young people in the Italian village who have always kind of made fun of him, but also the sex workers. Like, he sets the whole house on fire. And also he goes to visit Franco in the hospital after Franco has been accused of killing his wife and child, and then attempting suicide. And Della Morte actually says to him in the hospital, "Why are you mimicking my crimes?"
Well, no, at one point, no. Just to go back, there's a bit where the policeman comes to Della Morte and says, "Look, I found this at the scene of these fire," and it's Della Morte's check burnt up, and he says, "Well, that's evidence." Della Morte is saying, "Yeah, basically, arrest me then." And now I've got another man who's confessed to it all. Don't worry, you're off the hook, and leaves. And that's Franco, right?
Yeah.
Franco's admitted to the crimes Della Morte's done. It's so weird.
It is, and you can't get a kind of handle on it at all at this point. So, you know, by the hospital bed, Della Morte murders a nun. Mark, I thought of you.
Nuns!
Yeah. a nurse and a doctor, and then in a really brilliant shot, it's like a spiral staircase split in half, which to me seems to represent like the broken mind at this point of Della Morte. And he screams on the spiral staircase that he is the murderer, but nobody listens to him.
There's another great shot in this bit too, where you see when he's visiting this guy, he's not in a room, he's surrounded by I don't know what you call them, like hospital separators, entirely. So it's just like weird curtains around. And when the camera pans back, it's just this room surrounded with black all around it, like it's floating in, you know, space or something.
Right.
Do you know what I mean? It's absolutely very odd. It basically suggests it's fevered imagination. Thing.
And that's it. And like, because this is a such sights episode, you know, I'd really encourage both of you and anybody else who hasn't seen this to go back and watch it again, because every time you will pick up something new.
Yeah, it reminded me a bit, you know, in Creepshow, where Hal Holbrook has got that horrible nagging wife, and he just keeps imagining he's shot her in the head, and then suddenly you snap back to reality. It reminded me of that a bit. It was almost like, is he imagining all this?
Right.
Have we really lost it?
Because at that point, I had several theories. I was like, okay, so, like, is the guy laying there actually having these dreams? Like, is
Della Morte like a Jacob's Ladder kind of feel?
Yes.
Big kind of thing, yeah.
Right.
And it could be how it turns out. We just don't know, right?
Absolutely. They kind of, as we'll talk about it, the ending, because I'm very curious to hear.
We're getting there. We're getting very close.
Yeah, and, you know, again, for anyone who doesn't want the film totally spoiled, I mean, we've talked a lot about it already, but if you don't want it any more spoiled, stop now.
So at this point, Nagi and Della Morte pack up their car, they leave Buffalora. Nagi's head is injured when Della Morte, they're in like a car accident, and he slams on the brakes. They get out of the vehicle, walk to the edge of the road, and they see that it drops off into
put the brakes on, right? Because there was no more road. He slammed the brakes on when he saw that, and then Nagi hit his head. That's kind of what happened. Or maybe the bright light at the top. It was a bit confused, actually.
Again, convolution, you know? So the road drops off into a canyon or a chasm, and Nagi at this point begins to have some kind of seizure on the ground. Della Morte at this point, I think it's been interpreted that he thinks that the rest of the world does not exist.
Yeah, it's just, we tried to get out and it's not there. So the rest of the world isn't there. That's kind of his thing. And Nagi's kind of shaking. And at one point, he's not particularly sympathetic. He goes, come on, that was only a little hit. You'll be fine. And there's blood pouring out of his head.
Well, he, again, in terms of the depression and the nihilism, Della Morte takes out a gun, and it seems that it's going to end them both, but he can't.
He specifically loads two dum-dum bullets, doesn't he? Just
absolutely.
The two for the two of them.
Yeah.
And he doesn't seem to be able to do it, and Nagi wakes up. from whatever it recovers from whatever seizure he's experiencing. He drops the gun off the cliff. He asks to be taken home, which is interesting.
Yeah, he can talk now.
Yeah.
Now he talks for the first time, doesn't he? It's
absolutely. And it seems that Delamorte can only reply in the same way, and he says the same syllable, nah.
Nah. And it starts to snow, doesn't it?
It's snowing around them, and
like
we get the credits,
globe.
And the camera kind of pans out to reveal that they're standing in a snow globe.
Yeah, it's like Krampus.
That was also in the very beginning of the film. I caught that today, actually, because I wanted to rewatch a little bit of it.
I missed that in the beginning of the film.
I was like, oh, because I did not catch it the first time, which, again, Becky, I agree. I think you'll just see more and more as, you know, as you watch this again, because it's
absolutely
so many rich layers, right?
Absolutely. And I must admit, like, ever since I first watched this film, whenever I was forced to watch Citizen Kane afterwards, the opening scene, the snow globe, I was like, meh. There you go.
That's good as Delaware. Yeah.
I was like, they're in it.
Citizen Kane, yeah.
Citizen Kane, there you go.
But yeah, so Rupert Everett himself refers to the film as a play on life and death and love and sex. So he said that, you know, the cemetery itself is alive and the world is dead. And I wanted to kind of gauge your thoughts on that in terms of the ending.
I'm not sure how what he's just said relates to the ending. I think this is, I mean, I didn't
there is no world beyond it,
yeah,
basically.
I didn't realize there was a circularity. I didn't know the slow globe was at the beginning, but it kind of makes sense more from that. I'm not sure. I think it's a fever dream film about a man's progress through life at a certain stage in his life. And again, I can't see why you'd ever have a sequel to this, because it feels complete and whole. And doesn't need to be continued, and to continue it will probably dilute it, actually. So, yeah, I thought it was a really good film.
Yeah, I mean, you can definitely take that deep dive down the rabbit hole. There's a lot to discuss with the ending, I think, a lot of possibilities. It's, on one hand, you know, I kind of feel like he could have been just a made-up character from the person lying in that hospital bed, but then maybe, you know, maybe it is just saying, hey, there's nothing at the end of all this. I don't know. It's hard to interpret kind of what the director's saying, but I would say it's more of a, hey, make up your own mind kind of thing, you know, because I don't even know that they knew themselves, or if they did, they certainly didn't share it with us, you know, except what he said there.
Yeah. I'd agree.
What do you think, Becky?
I think, you know, the film itself, like, it's an exploration of what love can drive us to, how messy and complicated and gray it can be, and how it's linked inexorably to death itself. For me personally, the film, the more I watch it, is referencing toxic masculinity and that response to love, and if I can't have you, nobody will.
Think, I mean, that it's only really like that with the third incarnation, right? The second
one. It builds
one,
to that, if that makes sense. So
it does. So the first time,
I've watched this several times, so it's like the more I watch it, that's the more of the impression that I get.
That's
so the first time he loses her by accident or whatever, the second
by
time,
his cause, at his hand.
Yeah, the second time she just walks away and that's the end of it, and the third time he actively
The second time is still via rape, if you will, and, you know, male sexual dominance.
Yeah.
So
that's not him. He's not the active
agent. No, but it's male sexual dominance in itself. Not necessarily his character, but, like, from the beginning, he doesn't try to, you know, he shoots without looking. So he's not aware of the situation he potentially causes and her death and everything that continues from that. But eventually it's that sexual violence. So I thought it was a really interesting.
Yeah, so I mean, some of it seems to be by accident, certainly the first sort of incarnation. So that would suggest, if what you're saying is the thesis that would suggest that all of this is either his or someone else's fever dream rather than reality. 100%. Right?
Yeah. And I just thought it was really interesting that it explores that toxic masculinity in terms of Italian horror cinema.
Yeah. Yeah. She becomes more of a vessel than an active agent, which I think is probably true.
Yeah.
Mm. The that only woman with agency then appears to be the mayor's daughter, if that's the case.
yeah, true.
Would you say?
Yeah.
Appears to be so. There's also some commentary on, like, I guess, fatherhood and politics. Like, we've kind of, you know, like, don't jump on his bike because he's all right.
100%. And the film is full of, you know, like I say, there's so many layers, but the more you watch it, it's just very interesting how it explores that aspect of the character.
Can you imagine if they remade this as an American movie, you'd be hit over the head with it all, wouldn't you?
It wouldn't be unsaid. Well, again, and we'll come to that with, we're going to talk about another film as well on this episode. Yeah. So we will come to that. So just to say that, you know, Everett himself described the film as a unique insight into Italian village life and culture, and he also likened the film to Hammer films, but said that this was more thematically organized, which I thought was interesting. I wanted to get your, you know, your opinions on that, and also to say that, you know, as we've discussed, like, you know, I've mentioned this on several Listomania episodes for different reasons, but I wanted to get your opinion on how you rate it as a zombie film or a comedy horror, because it's such a wonderful blend of different artistic measures and influences.
Hammer, I'm having trouble with. I could see how you might do that with some of the later Hammer ones, which were much more experimental, say, you know, Vampire Circus, Twins of Evil, even Captain Kronos, and so on. But it's kind of stretching it, I think, to sort of suggest Hammer... this has something quite strongly akin to Hammer, because it really doesn't. I'd say it's more European horror, particularly Italian, obviously, but there's some other European. Like, for example, this might have more in common with Roman Polanski's Dance of the Vampires, which is a Hammer tribute kind of film in itself, than Hammer directly, if that makes sense. I rate this film very highly, but I really liked almost all aspects of it. We haven't really talked about it. The music was really outstanding. The theme tune, which did sound like something else, didn't it? I pointed out to you guys, it sounds like another theme tune, which is not a horror film. It's the theme tune to Two Mules for Sister Sarah, which is an Ennio Morricone track. It's got some similar beats to it. But I really like the music. The music's kind of quirky, a bit off kilter, so suitable for a horror film, but also a bit quirky, so suitable for a comedy, so that kind of helps too. It was shot really well. Rupert Everett was outstanding. There's no two ways about that. Yeah. So, you know, it just works as a film. I'd rate this very highly. I think it works as a comedy and a horror, and it's a very unusual entry in the zombie cycle. There's very few zombie films like this. There's more modern ones, perhaps, but certainly when it was made, not many at all.
Yeah, I'm in complete agreement with you there, Mark. I mean, I think it works as a comedy and a zombie film, and, you know, on the subject of Hammer, I'm in agreement there, too. Like, I really didn't see a lot of Hammer influence in it, but, you know, maybe that's what they were going for, but I definitely kind of felt the influence more of, like, Fulci kind of films more than anything else, because of that sort of fever dream aspect where it just, you didn't know where it was going to go next. But like we said in the beginning, or like I said in the beginning, you know, I do think it stays on track much better than your Fulci kind of zombie film. But yeah, it works great all around. It's a fun film, but also, you know, you can definitely take a lot from it as far as aspects of depression and, you know, issues with sex, politics, violence. You know, there's a lot this film is saying, and it's very interesting. I definitely rate it up there for sure.
The film blends myriad styles to create a metaphysical, philosophical, convoluted, and really beautiful realization of a comic strip. And I think that it's really interesting that we can read it in so many ways now, you know, so many years after it was originally produced, in terms of the politics and the cultural aspects, even though it seems to be so very uniquely designed to this idea of an Italian village in the 1990s. And that's brings me back to something that Rupert Everett actually said in a documentary, that so many films these days, you know, in order to be marketed and promoted, they have to fit in a certain box. And this film is completely outside the box. And I love it because of that. I think it's just wonderful. And as Lucard rightly said, there are so many layers and nuances that you have to peel away. And the more you watch it, the more you find, the more you think about. And it doesn't really have any final say on any of these ideas or themes. It just kind of puts them in your head for you to think about. And I think that's what makes the film a really interesting watch, especially to come back to. And for me personally, I think in terms of ratings, I would give this about a 9. What about you two?
I personally gave it an 8, but it's a high 8. So 9 seems reasonable. I think on a rewatch, it'll probably go up. I don't think it's ever going to go down on rewatch for me. I think it's a very solid. I think I'll see more in it the more I watch it. It's one of those. Because it's rich, right? It's just, it's one of those. So, yeah, I rate it very highly.
Yeah, I think I'm at a 9 for this one as well. It is really rich. It has such a depth to it. And I think, as you mentioned earlier, Becky, you know, it's got kind of that Tim Burton feel in a lot of ways. I mentioned, you know, Nightmare Before Christmas. To me, it's up there with sort of those kind of fantasy films, but more obviously for adults. So, yeah, definitely a high recommend.
Yeah, I wouldn't go too far away from, like, I don't know, Sleepy Hollow, right? That
yeah.
sort of thing.
Oh,
or
yeah.
even Sweeney Todd. It's yep. got that kind of look and vibe as well.
Yeah, exactly. That Burton kind of feel to it. That I don't know. I don't think many filmmakers really capture that, you know, except for Burton.
Yeah.
So, yeah,
and I think Del Toro as well in some aspects.
Yes, Del Toro, absolutely.
Yeah, I agree.
No, absolutely. And that brings us to the second film that we're talking about today, and only briefly, but I mentioned this one to you both because it is linked to Del Morte Del More, and that is Dylan Dog, Dead of Night from 2011. And this film, Michele Soavi was actually meant to direct a sequel to Del Morte Del More, but this is the film that we got instead. And I'm interested to think, first of all, what you both thought of a sequel to Del Morte Del More, because it stands out so much. I think it's such a standalone film.
Yeah, I've already kind of said I can't see why you'd ever want a sequel to that film, because it's so distinctive. I mean, I don't think you could have the story continue, because it just ended. You could possibly have a side quill or you know, someone else coming to the town and going through the same thing, but what would be the point? It's a bit, it just seems like an odd idea to try and do something with Del Morte actually.
Yeah, I agree with you. I mean, it's just people want to remake stuff nowadays, and they always want to, I guess, either make a remake or make a sequel. And some films just need to be left alone, in my opinion. Like just go watch the original film, because it's magical. And you really, certain films, I just don't think you can duplicate that formula. And this is certainly one of those films.
Yeah. Certain films lend themselves to remake. You know, they're sort of a perennial story that each generation can get something from. For example, I believe, I know they're pretty poor, but I think Stephen King's Carrie is a good idea to remake, because it just appeals to the different generations and the different lives we lead.
Yeah.
It's just it hasn't been executed well. But there's some stories that are so distinctive, it's like, just leave it, you know. Don't remake Rocky Horror Picture Show.
Exactly.
Don't Don't ever remake Highlander. I don't want to see a remake of Highlander.
Leave Wizard of Oz alone.
Yeah, that sort of thing. That sort of thing. But some, yeah, some do lend themselves to reinterpretation. And you know what? I'd be okay with someone possibly remaking Delamore. I know what I've just said, but remaking Delamore, Delamore, but not a sequel. I just don't see it.
I would be afraid of if they remade it. I don't think they would use the practical effects. I think they would lean heavily on CG, and I think that would be a problem. So, again, I think because of that, it would lose that magical quality.
Yeah, possibly. But imagine someone with the talent of, I don't know.
That's true.
Say David Lynch did it, or...
Del Toro, maybe.
I'm trying to think. So, yeah, Del Toro or Villeneuve, or, you know, it's possible.
Yeah,
it's
possible. I mean, there's always possibilities, that's true, but, man, at the same time, it's just like, you know, it to me anyway, more often than not, these remakes turn out so bad. Like, the only one I can think of offhand that we've covered recently that was, you know, really good was Evil Dead.
There's a few, you know, like The Crazies, and The Hills Have Eyes and so. Anyway, we're kind of getting off the point.
Yeah, we are.
Dylan Dong, right? Dylan Dong.
Yeah. What do you think, Becky?
I mean, I think it depends on how relatable the text is. And this one, in terms of Delamore, Delamore, as we've already expressed, you can apply so much of what we're feeling right now to the film. So it depends on that. I mean, just off the top of my head, for example, the new Craft film, which I think is a sequel. In one way, but you have like with Ghostbusters and the all, you know, women Ghostbuster remake, how so many people had an issue with that. It's for a different audience. And I'm sorry, but if you see that picture, that one little girl in, I think it was at the premiere, dressed up in the Ghostbusters kind of garb, looking up in awe at the stars of the film, that tells you why remakes can be completely viable.
I have no problem with remakes, personally. Not a problem at all, because the originals, as long as no one messes with the originals,
well, that's it. You've always got the original, and that's the thing, you know? You know, these remakes are for a different... At the end of the day, what I think a lot of people don't seem to take into account is that the remakes aren't always accessible in terms of relatability. And, you know, that's the thing with the Ghostbusters. I mean, there's a famous female critic who said that when she was a child, she wanted to go... as Halloween dressed to a party or whatever, dressed up as a Ghostbuster, but there were no costumes for girls and she was told not to. And she couldn't. And now this whole film changes that. And that, just to put that into perspective, as a woman in, you know, writing within the horror community, you know, I come against that every day personally. And that's why I think, you know, remakes can be absolutely fine. It's not a problem. It's when they lack any kind of creativity and they're just out to make money. You can tell the difference.
Yeah, I'm
indeed. You know, I'm comfortable with the Wicker Man remake, right? I don't really care.
I love it.
The first is so great, but it's it still entertains me. But there are some remakes that are better than the original. For example, The Thing.
I mean, the 1981 film. That may be my favorite horror movie, if not.
Indeed.
It's not my favorite horror movie, my favorite sci-fi movie for sure. You know, it's up there, man. That's a good one. So yeah, really good example there, Mark.
Yeah, absolutely. And like I say, you're not losing anything. So
yeah.
Some are as good, but different, you know, for especially some of the English foreign language to English. There's like, you know, Yojimbo was remade as Fistful of Dollars. Both great films.
Absolutely.
You know. Both viable and really good films. And then that's where it was remade again as Django. Great film. Different kind of film. And then it was remade again as, I can't remember the name, but there was like a 830s gangster remake of it with Bruce Willis, which is okay. But, you know, it's fine.
So on that tangent, in terms of adaptations, the comic follows the adventures of Dylan Dog, and he is a private investigator who lives in an apartment in London with his assistant Groucho, and it has a surrealist, darkly comedic and pensive tone. He's a vegetarian Dylan Dog, he's a recovered alcoholic, and he's a romantic loner with a fear of heights, small spaces and bats, which I thought was quite adorable. And the film itself, I mean, you commented, Mark, on, you know, private chats before, that you thought Brandon Routh was really great in the role.
Brandon Routh, I really like. Should have had a better career. It might have got wrecked by Superman Returns. But yeah, he was really good in this too. I've always liked him as an actor. I think he's got a lot of charisma and he works very well as like a hard-boiled detective in this. So yeah, I really liked him in this. I like the film as well. Let's just get out there. Yeah, I thought he was particularly good.
And the film Dylan Dog Dead of Night was adapted directly from the comics. It was, I believe, a 680-page collection of the original comic series, which was titled The Dylan Dog Case Files, was released in 2009 to tie in with the release of the film.
Yeah. So just to be clear, what's this, the relationship to this character, to Morte Dellamore?
Okay, so it was from a film that the creator, Tiziano Slavi, saw a film starring Rupert Everett and thought, you know what, he's got a great face. And he drew him as Dylan Dog. And Dylan Dog became a huge comic in Italy. Mm-hmm. And from that, he created Dellamorte Dellamore, which is more alongside the lines of what we have in the film itself, the original film. However,
right, so that's not directly related to Dylan Dog then. It's because it had the same comic book creator. Is that right?
Or yes. They're very kind of... They're linked in several ways. So obviously we have, you know, Rupert Everett and the way that he dispatches the zombies and such. And I think that Michele Soavi was meant to, as we talked about, the sequel to Dellamorte Dellamore, would have perhaps pulled the two together a little bit more.
Okay. That's so, starting to feel more like something that'd be interested, right?
Okay. Yeah, so okay. It's kind of pulling, so it's very much thematically, both Dylan Dog and Dellamorte Dellamore, the original text, not the filmic adaptations, they explore this duality between love and death.
Right.
And that is a creator's signature kind of area, I believe. And as I spoke about slightly before, Francesco Dellamorte as a character very confusingly appears in, I think it's two episodes of the comic, two like special episodes, Black Horror and Falling Stars. So he exists outside of the character of Dylan Dog, but Rupert Everett was obviously the genesis of that character and how that character looked. And it's all kind of come full circle. So I think there are very much, and again, I'll reiterate that I haven't read Dellamorte Dellamore, but it seems like there are more elements pulling that through. And I think there's more, there are more links between the two than I'm laying on here.
Okay, well, they both exist in the universe where zombies and vampires and werewolves and whatever exists, right? So
this he's a caretaker in Dellamorte Dellamore, and then in Dylan Dog, he's a PI who's I think is it his girlfriend or his sister who's killed by?
I think it's his girlfriend, right?
His girlfriend, yeah.
It's his wife, isn't it?
I'm sorry, his wife is killed by vampires, and he then is just a PI. He doesn't do any supernatural work, but he gets kind of drawn back into that. So the film itself, Dylan Dog Dead of Night, is set in New Orleans instead of London. And they renamed Groucho Marcus as his sidekick due to copyright issues. And the film is kind of lighter. So again,
this is a fun film. Yeah.
Well, we've talked about this before, for example, with Constantine.
It's any sort of supernatural detective stuff. So Constantine's kind of an obvious parallel, isn't it?
But specifically the TV series that we've spoken about before. And the TV series, for me personally, did not hit that the tone correctly. It needed to be a lot darker. And I think if you go into, what's it called?
The Punisher?
Yes. Is it the third film, which is incredibly dark and very violent?
I'm confused.
Punisher. Talking? So you had the Punisher with Thomas Jane, the first film.
Yeah, it wasn't great.
Sorry, not the first one. The first one was Dolph
Lundgren.
Yeah, and then Thomas Jane one, and then the third one. I can't remember the actor's name, but the film is very, very dark and violent. And I think that personally, very much It very much
that was proper channels, Punisher. Yes,
exactly. It channels the comic much more than the rest.
Yeah, interestingly, Thomas J. Yeah, I really like Thomas J. as the Punisher, but he was in a really bad film. And funnily enough, I think of Brendan Routh in the same way. I thought he was a really good Superman in a really bad Superman film.
100%.
Yeah, so it's getting that tone right. Yeah, the Dolph Lundgren one had it right, and then they went wrong, and then they got it right again. Is how that went. Yeah, Dylan Dog does. It's kind of interesting. There is a very niche subgenre of detective movies which are about supernatural detectives, and Dylan Dog's in that. Constantine's it. There's one with Fred Ward called about the Lovecraftian side of things called Cast the Deadly Shadow, that's kind of similar.
Makes me think of the Angel TV series.
Yeah, I don't know much about that, but it sounds like it's sort of similar. It was fun. This film was fun, but it's like similar to a lot of other similar films. It didn't do well in the box office, I noticed, which is a shame. I think it was a pretty solid film, actually.
I'm curious, was this actually released? Did it get a theatrical release?
Well, hold on. I think it did, but it did. It had a budget of $20 million. It made $5 million back at the box office, which isn't good, is it?
Yeah, that's pretty rough. I don't think we'll see a sequel to it then, but...
And some of the tropes in it, Becky, like the vampire blood being used as a drug, that's in True Blood, isn't it? The TV series True Blood is a thing. So I thought that was interesting.
Yeah, I like how the clan is called the True Bloods.
They are, aren't they? Yes, I admit that, but yes. I mean, the vampires in this are like underworld vampires, aren't they? Or Buffy vampires. Or
and
it's
also,
that kind of thing, isn't
it? Shadow Hunters, based on the book series, the new TV series.
Yeah, I could definitely see Dylan Dog encountering the vampires from What We Do in the Shadows. I could definitely see that.
Oh, that would be great.
And he's at pace. The other one it was a bit like, and this is a bit of a stretch, is Who Framed Roger Rabbit, where Bob Hoskins' detective is happily interacting with a world that has toons, whereas this is vampires and werewolves, right?
Which kind of reminds me of Delamorte Delamore.
Yeah, yeah. Indeed, yes.
And the name of the original film as well, we must say, the Delamorte tells Nagi at one point that his mother, her maiden name was Delamore.
Okay.
And she married into the Delamorte family, so...
Okay, so it's his mother's name, kind of.
So, like, love and death. Again, love and death. It's kind of duality, yeah.
Yeah, okay. I don't know if we want to get into the plot too much of this, but, you know, it's got werewolves and vampires, and in many ways it's kind of similar to Blade 2, isn't it?
Yeah, I got a Blade vibe from it, too. It's a lower-budget Blade, essentially.
Yeah, And it moved from kind of comedy action. Oh, there was definitely a hard-boiled detective mode, you know, a Mickey Spillane, Sam Spade kind of vibe through it. So much so, I got confused sometimes by the plot, because that is what happens with hard-boiled detective stories. The plots are so convoluted, you get confused. But then it evolved into more of an action film, and it reminded me of not just Blade 2, but it made me think of the Solomon Kane movie. At the end, where it became all action and big monsters and stuff like that.
They even tried to do some John Woo shooting in there. That doesn't really work too well, but I thought the martial arts, like the fight scenes, were actually pretty strong.
Yeah, it was fine. They were pretty brief, but it was pretty strong. And it had a fantastic internal logic again, didn't it? Like, there was these clans and, you know, they had certain ways of acting, and there was these people... Yeah. That sort of interacted with them, and it was like vampires and werewolves were a thing in this universe,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, a little bit like Vampire the Masquerade going on too.
Yeah, and again, True Blood, you know, where vampires absolutely become public knowledge, and stuff like that. So I thought it was pretty solid. Yeah. There wasn't Peter Stormare was in this, wasn't he? And he was pretty terrific, and so there's a connection there with Constantine. He's his version of Satan in Constantine is amazing. And he did it. He's again that creepy, angry dude.
Yeah, he's just always awesome kind of in anything.
He always plays that. I mean, in John Wick 2, he was. Was it 2? Yeah, 2. He was pretty good as well.
I still got to see that.
Yeah, oh, man. Yeah.
The first John Wick. Oh, so good.
Yeah. All three are pretty solid. Anyway, yeah. But the plot's very convoluted, isn't it? We finally get there.
Oh, my God. It's all over the place. And also, instead of New Orleans, it looks like L.A. Like you guys are not fooling anybody with this.
Yeah, apart from the last shot.
Right.
It looks like Bourbon Street.
Yeah.
It?
So, that's maybe the only thing they shot in New Orleans.
Yeah. Yeah, so this was the first time watch for us too. How many times have you seen it, Becky?
This would be the second time.
Second time.
Yeah.
Yeah, really enjoyed it. It's a significantly shallower field than Delamorte Delamore, isn't it? But it's kind of fun, and it deserves a bit of love, I'd say.
Yeah, I think it's worth a watch, you know. I mean, I like my low-budget kind of horror action anyway. So, you know, having not seen this in the theater even, you know, because I thought it was probably just direct to DVD or direct to video, but I really enjoyed it with that in mind. You know, it's worth it, I think. Worth an hour and 30 minutes of your time.
Yeah, it definitely felt like an 80s kind of horror film, didn't
it?
Yeah,
oh,
80s. What do you think, Beck?
Yeah, no, I mean, very much for me, channeled the 90s vibe with religious horror and such. From that time, but you know, I'd be interested to find out what you both think in terms of, you know, would you watch this as a standalone? Would you recommend it as a standalone?
Yeah, I think it's definitely worth a look. It reminded me of some ways. There's a whole set of old Dracula films, and I can't remember who made them, but they were from about this time and it had a similar vibe. This is better than those, though. Actually, saying that, I actually get this. This is my Letterboxd review of this film, right? Fun hardboiled detective meets Monster Squad with a touch of Blade 2.
That's perfect.
That's how I put it.
That's perfect.
So yeah, it was light. It got serious in the last act because it was action, right? But it was pretty light and it was kind of funny. I like the fact it had like zombie or the reanimated were working in the morgue and that could function in society, and there was even like a support group for zombies, wasn't there, and stuff like that. All of that was kind of fun.
Yeah, his friend
who kind of still functioned, but there was this whole rare thing about, right, you've got a totally different health regime now, right? So you know, got to drink bleach. And it was something like this. And it was constantly, he has to eat worms. And he's like, oh, that's gross. But in the end, he kind of comes around, doesn't he? He goes into a restaurant and orders all this stuff. And they say, give him a number 9. And it's a worm burger, basically.
I don't want that.
And then he likes it.
Definitely like a different caliber of film. You know, the two films are very different, I feel like, but this is kind of fun, you know?
Yeah, this is, I'll tell you what, the pair of them reminded me in terms of changing tone and depth, and so it's like saying Conan the Barbarian and then Conan the Destroyer, you know, same you universe, same rules, completely different tones. I liked
it. You've nailed it there. I think you've nailed it.
I agree.
Well, what would you give it as a rating? Out of
10? I'd give it a 6. Maybe 6.5. It was fun and worth the watch. I might watch it again sometime. I particularly like the fact we don't have many hardball detective stories these days. You know, this tone, this kind of riffing on the 30s and 40s kind of tone. So I really like that aspect of it. And it was entertaining enough as it went on.
Yeah, I think I'm at about the same mark. I think I'd probably give it a 6. You know, I've seen far, far worse than this and watched far worse than this. So I don't think you can go wrong with it. And again, if you sort of like lower budget action or horror movies, you'll have an appreciation for it. I think it's got an audience. Whether it relates, you know, to the previous film or not. And I think it does stand alone. Like, you can watch one without the other. And they're two just totally different films, pretty much. as far as like plot and everything. So, you know, so yeah, check it out.
Yeah, and I think it'd be a 6-2. You know, in terms of adaptations of Tiziano Slave's work, I think that thematically the Dell'Amore to Dell'Amore just encapsulates everything in terms of, you know, Dylan Dog much more than this, even though it's meant to be a direct adaptation, if that makes sense. So, yeah, I think I'd be at 6 for it. And that closes this episode. So thank you for listening. And we'll be back next time with more United Nations of Horror.
Thanks for listening to the United Nations of Horror. Visit us online at www.unhpodcast.com. Come join us on Facebook to chat about all things horror. Just look up United Nations of Horror and you'll find our group. You can also find us on Twitter at UNH Podcast. And be sure to look for our old episodes on YouTube with added video and some special treats. As always, I want to thank everyone for your continued support. Until next time, I've been Lucar Dragomir, wishing you sweet nightmares.